This is People First Radio On Demand, podcasts, streaming, and MP3 downloads, available when you want to listen at chly.ca, iTunes, and at the People First Radio website.
CHLY 101.7 FM, Vancouver Island. On the web, www.chly.ca.
In July 2003, at the age of 45, David Carmichael experienced his first major depression, and he was prescribed the SSRI antidepressant Paxil. By September, David was feeling mentally healthy again, and by February 2004, still feeling well, he weaned himself off the drug. David suddenly started to experience the symptoms of major depression again, 4 months later in July.
David put himself back on Paxil using a previous prescription and thought he could recover more quickly if he increased the dosage. 3 days after increasing his dosage of Paxil, David went from planning his own suicide to planning a murder-suicide to planning a murder. On July 31, 2004, David Carmichael killed his 11-year-old son Ian in London, Ontario. He was charged with first-degree murder.
David was diagnosed as being in a major depression with psychotic episodes when he killed Ian. On September 30, 2005, David was judged to be not criminally responsible on account of a mental disorder for murdering Ian, and he was sent to Brockville Mental Health Center.
We're joined on the phone by David Carmichael. Welcome to People First Radio, David.
Oh, it's nice to be part of a difficult conversation.
David, the CTV program W5 presented a documentary in 2007 about your experiences. W5 writes on its website, "It was a picture of the perfect Toronto family, David Carmichael, a nationally known fitness guru, his two children and wife, Elizabeth." Tell us about the time before your illness.
Well, before my first major depression, we had a great family. There were four of us. Both my daughter Jillian and son Ian were doing well. My wife and I were running a company together. I was doing contract work and juggling a lot of contracts. And, you know, like many families, dealing with some excessive sort of financial pressures was probably the first trigger, which sent me into my first major depression.
You began to change in 2003. You visited your family doctor. What was happening to you, and what prompted that visit?
Well, you know, the first thing for me, I started to experience symptoms like insomnia, higher anxiety than I had in the past. And to me, one of the major issues was some rapid weight loss. Plus, I lost confidence in tasks that were incredibly simple for me in the past. And I could not literally get out of bed. I would much rather have had two broken legs than feel the way that I felt. I was totally debilitated. So I went to the family doctor. He had put me on the prescription of Paxil at 40 milligrams without telling me any of the side effects. And so just start taking this. And 5 weeks later, I was actually functioning well again.
You felt better after a period of time, as you mentioned. You weaned yourself off Paxil, but then your depression returned. Tell us how that manifested itself.
Well, like many people on these drugs, the side effects you know, it can be quite uncomfortable. And in my case, sort of into the new year, in 2004, I was dealing with some extra weight gain. Also, I was sweating really easily and some sexual dysfunction type of issues. So I picked up a book on drugs in Canada and I talked with a couple of other people that had been on Paxil, and I slowly weaned myself off of the drug and felt great for 4 months. But at the time, I had been juggling about 8 different contracts, doing very well. And in hindsight, I look back on it now, there's no question that in my first major depression, Paxil actually made me manic. And I was able to do more work, sleep less, drive forever. I look back on this and I was functioning probably above where I normally do function when I was never on an antidepressant. And still, you know, after weaning myself off 4 months later, still trying to juggle all the contracts, I got into a state where I was sleep deprived, and that triggered my relapse.
What happened next?
Well, when I finally intervened at a reasonable time in my relapse, you know, because the doctor never told me any side effects I'd experienced, and my and I had a full prescription for when I weaned myself off, I put myself back on 40 milligrams of Paxil. I started to have sort of suicidal thoughts, and I actually went even a step further. I started to have suicidal ideations and planning and looking. So I actually thought, you know, not knowing the drug very well, and at the time there were no real warnings out from Health Canada or in the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, that I thought if I took a little more, that would be better. So I went back to the book that I bought back when I weaned myself off in 2004, and it said that I could take up to 60 milligrams of Paxil. So I, without talking to my doctor, he had told me that in the past he had prescribed 60 milligrams. And I knew someone else who had been on 60 milligrams, so I thought there was nothing wrong with just increasing my own dosage, and it would probably help me get better quickly, because I thought that the suicidal thoughts came from the illness. Later to find out that it might have been triggered by the drug.
You became acutely psychotic and delusional. How did that manifest itself?
Well, after I'd put myself on 60 milligrams, I, you know, got right into not acting out a suicide, but certainly looking at where I could commit it. And then I got into sort of suicidal, homicidal ideation. And it was 2 weeks after that I'd started the drug that I was severely psychotic. I had five different delusions that, you know, after I came out of my psychosis, they don't make any sense to me. And I guess the best way to describe my psychosis is like being in a dream, and there are many people, you have a dream and you wake up and you go, thank goodness that was a dream. Well, in my case, you know, my psychotic episode was actually real, and when I came out of my psychotic episode, it was just a nightmare. But I had five different delusions. I thought my son had permanent brain damage, Ian. I thought he was in living hell, that kids were teasing him and picking on him. I thought he was going to kill my daughter. I thought my wife was going to have a breakdown, and that he was going to hurt other children. So it's a time when you're severely psychotic. You know, in my particular case, I didn't know right from wrong, and I thought that, you know, I knew I'd go to prison for killing him, but it was the best thing to do morally, and I took his life on July 31st.
And on July 31st, 2004, you then left that hotel in London, and you turned yourself in, didn't you?
I called 911. I stayed with Ian. You know, after I had killed him, I stayed with him for 6 hours before I called the police, just because I didn't want to call them in the middle of the night. I called the police at 9 o'clock in the morning. I explained what happened. I was very calm, very organized. I could be the person sitting at the next desk to somebody listening to your show. I was calm. I was organized. But part of my mind was severely broken and delusional. You know, I didn't have any hallucinations. I didn't see things or hear things. I was delusional.
This is People First Radio, only on CHOY 101.7 FM and streaming at CHOY.ca.
David Carmichael became seriously depressed and was prescribed the SSRI antidepressant Paxil. Over time, his symptoms improved and he weaned himself from the drug. But on the return of his symptoms, he increased his dosage of Paxil and became delusional and psychotic. David Carmichael strangled his son Ian in a London, Ontario hotel room on July 31, 2004. He was later judged to be not criminally responsible on account of mental disorder for murdering Ian and was sent to Brockville Mental Health Center. David presented a session at the Psych Out Conference in Toronto, Ontario on May 8, 2010, called Taking Our Health Back from Big Pharma Controlled Governments. David Carmichael shares his story with us today.
David, what does it mean to be judged not criminally responsible on account of a mental disorder?
Well, fundamentally, the easiest way to explain this is it means that, you know, you're not in the mental state to know right from wrong. And what you did and what you committed, the act you committed, you actually thought was right. Now, whether it's legally right or morally right, the issue was, and there was no question through the psychiatrist that assessed me from the Royal Ottawa Healthcare Group, plus another psychiatrist that the Crown Attorney had assessed me from the Centre for Addiction and Mental Health in Toronto, CAMH, that I had suffering from severe depression, and that I had a psychotic episode, a very severe homicidal psychotic episode, you know, tied in with the severe depression. There was no question about that. And in that severe psychotic episode, I did not know right from wrong. The real controversy is what triggered the psychotic episode.
You received an absolute discharge from the Ontario Review Board on December the 4th, 2009. What does that mean? What is an absolute discharge, and how does that impact your life?
Well, an absolute discharge means that the psychiatrist, and I've seen 15 forensic psychiatrists in the Ontario Review Board, which is really a panel of five people. There's a psychiatrist, psychologist, a lawyer, usually a retired judge or a justice of the peace, plus someone from the community. Take a look at your case, and if you're no longer deemed to be a significant risk to yourself or to others, then they are required by law to provide you with an absolute discharge. Now, in the process, there's obviously a tremendous amount of treatment that goes on prior to that. And if you are deemed not to be a risk, then you have your life back in the sense of having an absolute discharge. Up until that point, there's all types of conditions tied in with what they call a disposition order.
You're living in the community, reunited with your family, and you've said that the most debilitative part of your illness at this point in your life is the shame, stigma, and silence associated with it. Tell us more about that.
Well, I think with mental illness, I think there are many ways to treat mental illness, and right now I'm, you know, taking a look at sort of the exercise and the physical activity benefits of on mental health, which is sort of where my future is going, either through quality sport programs, through walking, other activities. I think my illness has been well treated. I'm in full remission now. I'm not even on an antidepressant at this time. I was on Effexor for 4 years, and in consult with a forensic scientist psychiatrist from Australia, I actually slowly tapered from that particular drug, along with a sort of medical support team, you know, where I'm living now in Huntsville, Ontario, and doing very well, looking at other options, including, you know, there's talk therapy, there's exercise, there's healthy eating, all those things are, and certainly reducing some of the financial pressures that triggered my first major depression in 2003. So you can actually function well. The bigger issue, and even among people who have mental illnesses themselves, there's a stigma of a forensic label and someone struggling with mental illness. But it's really the discrimination that goes along with mental illness out in the community. I've worked through the shame. I've worked through tremendous guilt, literally, emotionally, certainly of having to find my resilience, because, you know, it's very hard to even find a job for anybody to even talk with you. They're afraid I'm going to have another psychotic episode. There's just so much lack of knowledge, you know, around mental illness, period, not to mention forensic mental illness, that's the greater challenge right now. It's not my mental health. It's not my relationships with my wife and my daughter. We have reconciled. It really is the sort of lack of understanding, or even a lack of willingness to try to understand how something like this could happen.
You founded the Health Promotion Party of Canada, a political party, and you plan to run against Conservative Member of Parliament Tony Clement in the next election. Tell us more about that and what that means to you at this point in your life.
Well, you know, there are a number of ways to raise issues, and I think, you know, in my particular case, after everything happened, you know, soon after my index offense, so that I killed Ian, there were a team of doctors, medical doctors, that were doing tests with me to try to prove that I was in a major depression. And in fact, the test results showed the opposite, and it was never presented in my court case. My IQ was higher than normal. I completed a 520-some-odd question inventory called the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory in 45 minutes. Even in a normal state, it would take me probably an hour and a half to 2 hours. When I was in a depressed state, actually, at the Royal Ottawa, it took me over 3 hours. It showed that I was not in a major depression. I was so strong in my delusions that they could not tell that I was psychotic or not, because there were no breaks in my psychosis. That, along with DNA evidence recently collected in November 2009 from Australia, sort of demonstrate that the actual drug triggered the psychosis, Paxil. Now, of course, GlaxoSmithKline will adamantly deny it because they're not going to open themselves up to any type of civil litigation, and we've chosen public education versus civil litigation. And one way to educate the public is to raise the issues. If you're talking about prescription drug safety, one of the best places to raise the issues is in a federal election. Tony Clement was a provincial minister of health in Ontario. He was also a federal minister of health in the last decade, when our healthcare costs have gone from $90 to $180 billion across the country. But when he was appointed the federal minister of health in 2006, he also owned at the time 25% of a pharmaceutical company. So I felt there was no better place for me to raise the issues than in Tony Clement's backyard up in Parry Sound, Muskoka.
At the Psych Out conference in Toronto in May 2010, which I attended, and I heard your session there, you said that this is, quote, a David versus Goliath battle, and that your battle is going to be political. You told us, the people in the room at your presentation, myself included, you're very courageous to even be here. What did you mean by that?
Well, I meant David versus Goliath because the big blue machine is going to be virtually impossible to defeat, which is really not, I'm not expecting to be able to defeat Tony Clement. I'm not quite sure. You know, to me, speaking out is not an issue of courage at all. Actually, it's a responsibility I have to Ian and to my daughter Jillian, who's about 20 years old. So to me, it's not about courage. This is just about the right thing to do. These issues need to be raised. Prescription drug safety needs to be raised. I've been reading articles from the Vancouver newspapers recently. There's issues right across the country with mental illness, and there's an issue right now with the BC government where a therapeutic group that was doing some drug safety work up until recently, is their funding is in jeopardy, and the actual provincial government may be the ones to scrutinize drug safety, and part of their sort of team that's going to do that is they're going to provide pharmaceutical companies with the opportunities to review what they suggest before they actually pass any policies or any legislation. So I think the issue to me is not one of courage, it's one of necessity. Our healthcare system is controlled by pharmaceutical companies, and I think anybody who thinks any otherwise is incredibly naive.
You were in Washington, D.C. last week. Tell us about that experience.
Well, I went to Washington. It was a Sixth World Conference on the promotion of mental health and the prevention of mental and behavioral disorders, and I was there talking about the benefits of exercise and quality sport programs that build self-esteem among young people as a way to prevent them from being involved with mental illnesses in the first place. The experience itself, you know, there were 40 countries represented. I talked with several psychiatrists, and what's very interesting with the particular drug that I have my tragic experience with, is nobody really understands it. A psychiatrist from at least 12 different countries, I asked them about how you would identify a Paxil-induced psychosis, and their answers were all over the map, from, I would never prescribe that drug, it's the worst of all the drugs, to, it doesn't trigger psychosis. Yet, in Canada, in the Compendium of Pharmaceuticals and Specialties, it's called the CPS, it says it triggers psychosis, but doctors don't even know that. To, actually, in the Scandinavian countries, they actually understood that you have to be very careful because someone could be severely psychotic and you wouldn't even know, because they're not bouncing around. It's not what they call akathisia. It's sort of, you get through that stage, your mind is just delusional. If you're not hearing voices and talking to voices or looking around like you're saying things, when you're just delusional, it's very hard to tell. As I said, it could be a colleague sitting at the desk next to you. So I think, to me, there was a really clear understanding. And, you know, if you actually... anybody Googled a DVD that I posted on YouTube called Greed, Fraud, and Paxil, it's quite clear that the area where pharmaceuticals are probably most grossly misrepresented in terms of research, and where there's huge ethical issues around research, are psychotropic drugs. And Dr. Charles Nemiroff, formerly from Emory University, you know, had disclosed that he had made $35 million consulting to GlaxoSmithKline over a six-year period, 2000 to 2006, when he was doing independent government-funded clinical trials in the United States on Paxil. We actually made just under $1 million. He's also ghostwritten articles, which means he signs articles, puts his name to them, that are written by the research team at GlaxoSmithKline. So there are so many ethical, fraudulent issues around psychotropic drugs that I think we really don't know anything about them in many ways. I think, you know, certainly the 12 or so countries that I talked with psychiatrists from, and they didn't know why I was there, and they didn't know my story. I could have been another psychiatrist. When I talked to them about Paxil, the answers were all over the place, which makes it really clear to me that even psychiatrists don't understand the drug.
David Carmichael, we only have a moment left in our discussion with you today. I'm wondering if there's anything else you'd like to add.
Well, I'm working on a short paper right now. It's it'll probably be on my website, davidcarmichael.com, within the next couple of months. But it's called Recognizing Paxil-Induced Psychosis, Expert Opinion and Reflections from a Homicide. And it really is going to contrast my experience with what I picked up in Washington from 12 different countries, psychiatrists from 12 different countries, about what they do not understand about what this particular drug and other SSRIs can actually do. So I appreciate you putting this on air. I think it's a very important, it's a very difficult thing for me to talk about, but it's a very important issues to raise with the public in this country. And
thank you very much, David, for taking the time to join us today.
Well, you're welcome, Kevin.
You can find David Carmichael online at davidcarmichael.com. David's more recent publication, Killer Side Effects, What GlaxoSmithKline Does Not Seem to Want Anyone to Know About Paxil, is available in PDF format on David's website. And you can find the Health Promotion Party of Canada website at healthpromotionparty.ca.
This is a People First Radio podcast. People First Radio is an initiative of Columbian Centre Society in partnership with Radio Malaspina Society and produced at CHLY Community Radio in Nanaimo, British Columbia. The opinions expressed in this interview do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the partnering organizations. Visit us online. Just Google People First Radio to find our webpage.